the rich, melodic song of the blackbird, one of the true stars of the dawn chorus. The blackbird is one of the first birds to begin singing each morning, during late spring and early summer, just as the very first glimmer of light appears in the sky. It is a sound that has inspired poets and composers for centuries. Its mellow, flute-like quality, touching something deep in the human soul.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arrive.
Blackbirds are frequent visitors to Irish gardens, where they can be seen both hopping on lawns in search of worms and feeding on berries high in trees and bushes. But they have a penchant for apples, which are a great way to attract them into your garden and which can also be a real lifeline for them during periods of bad weather.
That should do it. Now, most people know that blackbirds love apples, and the pair I have here in the back garden, well, they're no different. But these two actually have a preference for Golden Delicious over all others. When I put out apples, I always put out two or three varieties together. I've tried Granny Smiths, Pink Ladies, Braeburns and whatever other kinds are in season. But these two always devour the Golden Delicious first.
A key member of the Moonygoes Wild team, Terry Flanagan, has worked as a science and biology teacher for the past 40 years. His interest in wildlife and nature was instilled in him by his father at a very early age. Terry has a fascination for a wide range of different creatures, from insects to mammals to birds, and the blackbird is one of his favourites. A pair has been nesting in his garden for as long as he can remember, and Terry is keen to bring the story of this special bird to a wider audience.
I throw most of the apples on the ground. They prefer to feed off the ground, and they seldom venture onto the bird table. And even as I'm here, I see the male on the hedge. He's only waiting for me to go back inside, and then he'll be down to feast. It's been like this for years now. I know it's not the same pair that's been here for so long, but I like to think they are. Pretty much every year, they nest in the garden, so they're probably a number of generations of the same family. Anyway, it's time to go back inside and let him enjoy his lunch.
The blackbird is one of the easiest Irish birds to identify. His plumage is jet black, with his bright yellow beak and legs and the yellow ring around each eye, readily distinguishing him from any species of crow and indeed from any other European bird. The female is dark brown rather than black, with duller legs and bill, and if viewed closely, some darker spotting and streaking is usually visible on her throat and breast, making her look like a very dark thrush, which is exactly what she is. The blackbird is the most common member of the thrush family found in Ireland, and across Europe for that matter. Blackbirds are also very popular birds. It helps that it is one of Ireland's most common species, a familiar sight and sound in parks and gardens and forests and farms the length and breadth of the country. It is a bird that is readily encountered no matter where in Ireland you happen to live. As Brian Burke, coordinator of Birdwatch Ireland's annual Garden Bird Survey, explains.
So the Birdwatch Ireland Garden Bird Survey has been running since the late 80s and running in its current format since 94-95. And basically every winter for a period of 13 weeks in December, January and February, we ask people to let us know what they're seeing in their gardens. So each week they tell us what species they're seeing in their gardens and they tell us the highest count they got in that week. And it's very popular. We get, you know, it's a citizen science survey, so we get hundreds of people all over the country participating every winter, and a lot of people find it a great way to kind of get a good idea of what's going on in their gardens, and it provides really important, really interesting data for us to see how those birds are doing over the winter and see how they fare in good winters compared to bad winters and things like that. So it's provided some really interesting information over the last 20 and 30 years.
Now, I know that there are literally thousands of people sending in records to you over the last number of years. You must have gleaned a huge amount of information from that.
Absolutely. And some of the information, you know, is quite consistent in that we get robins, blackbirds, blue tits and grey tits in nearly every garden, in nearly every winter. So even that, you know, as boring as it might sound to some people, that's really interesting information in itself. And in the colder winters in particular, you see real dips in numbers of wrens and goldcrests, and you can get quite unusual birds turning up in gardens. But it really does provide a really good snapshot each winter, because we do have surveys during the breeding season and the nesting season, but this one provides a good idea of what's going on the other half of the year.
And the blackbird. I know the blackbird has come in number two position, I think, for the last, 10 years or so now.
If we look at the last 25 years or so, two-thirds of that, 14, 15 years, the blackbird has been in number two and literally a handful of gardens behind the robin each year. So it's always second to the robin and always a couple of gardens more than the blue tit as well. Back in 2009-10, which was a very cold winter, I think it actually topped the robin in that year. So that was one of the few years it was actually the most popular bird in Irish gardens that winter.
Now, originally, blackbirds would not have been a garden bird. They must have been what, a woodland bird?
Yeah, so they were specially adapted to kind of woodland edge. So they would nest in hedgerows and in trees and in shrubs and stuff like that. And kind of as their numbers, you know, they'd be in very high densities in the countryside. And around 150 years ago in Western Europe, places like Germany, and that some blackbirds were pushed into urban areas, into people's gardens, into parks and places like that. And they started to really do well in the cities and towns. And that kind of spread throughout Europe then. In subsequent decades. So in the last century, they've become a real common feature in gardens and parks and places like that.
Well, in my garden, I have a pair of blackbirds, but they never, ever come to the table. They always feed from the ground. Is that the kind of results you'll be getting from around the country?
In Birdwatch Ireland, we get a lot of questions about how to attract different birds to gardens. And, you know, we try and get people to appreciate that some birds prefer to hang from feeders and stuff, but birds like robins and blackbirds and dunnocks will hop around in the ground and they'll kind of search for invertebrates and worms and things like that. And then also just little bits of seeds and fruit and things like that that kind of fall on the ground. So they are specially adapted to hop around on the ground, and that's where they prefer to feed.
Why do you think blackbirds are doing so well in people's gardens?
Well, they seem to just have realised that there's a lot of there was available habitat, first of all, in gardens and in parks and stuff like that. And in the urban environment, temperatures are much higher. So during the winter, when it gets quite cold, they get a bit of an advantage and they don't have to burn as much fat or use up as much energy in these kind of warmer urban environments. And then, of course, people leaving out food and people with trees with various berries and fruits and stuff like that, they all give blackbirds a real good boost over the winter period and help them survive and start the spring well.
I know with my pair of blackbirds, he's up every morning singing from about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. I enjoy it, but not all of my neighbours enjoy it.
No, some people some people like their beauty sleep, you know, in the mornings and like to go to bed early and that, and some people find it annoying. But it's a really beautiful call, and I think, you know, the majority of people would really appreciate it and really enjoy hearing it. And because blackbirds as well, they have quite a large eye compared to the size of their body compared to other birds. They're usually the first ones up in the morning, the first ones singing and the first one people hear before they go to work.
Are they very territorial? I ask that because I notice in my garden I never ever see two males. I only ever see a male and a female.
The males are really, really aggressive. They'll really guard their territory, even in winter. You know, they'll really, really keep an eye on their patch. And it's actually their orange bill that triggers that aggression. So you'll notice that the females usually have, sometimes it's a bit yellow in the bill, but usually it's kind of a dark, kind of brownish colour in the bill. So that doesn't trigger that aggressive response in the males. And even the young blackbirds will have a bill very similar to the female. So that is not orange. It doesn't trigger that response. But if a male blackbird sees another male blackbird with an orange bill, it'll use up all its energy chasing it out of its territory.
Have you estimated the numbers of blackbirds in Ireland?
In the summer, there's somewhere in the region of 5 million blackbirds. Now that kind of goes up in some years and down in some years. You know, it might have been a cold winter or a poor breeding season the year before, but somewhere around 5 million blackbirds. So that's somewhere between 2 and 3 million pairs of blackbirds around Ireland every summer.
What's the greatest challenge then for the blackbird in the garden?
Actually, from ringing studies in Ireland and the UK and in other countries, they found that the major cause of mortality, so the main things that ends up killing blackbirds each year, are cars and cats. So we really do ask people to be responsible pet owners and to keep their cats inside, or to not make it easy for their cats to catch birds like blackbirds. And because the blackbird feeds on the ground and is always hopping around on the ground, it's particularly prone to attacks from cats that might be waiting in bushes and things like that.
Familiar though they may be, scientists are still learning new things about blackbirds, especially about their lifespans and their movements. One of the main ways this sort of information is gathered is through ringing, the process by which a small, individually numbered metal ring is fitted to the leg of a bird by a trained ornithologist. One such bird ringer is Declan Manley from Edenderry in County Offaly.
So a male blackbird.
Nice male blackbird here.
And he's just biting you on the hand there. So, he's a ring bird.
Yeah, it's very. Their beak is so soft. So, like when they bite you, you don't even feel it. Whereas that was a blue tit, now he'd be screaming, all right.
He's absolutely beautiful.
He's lovely, yeah. He's
just lost one little feather there, a downy feather.
Yeah, they do kind of, when you catch them sometimes, it's called a stress molt. And they do it if a bird of prey is around, they'll actually drop some feathers and then there's a cloud of feathers and the predator will kind of get confused and maybe grab a feather rather than the bird.
Right.
You know, so that's what he's kind of doing now. He's dropping feathers, kind of trying to distract me, like, you know.
Now you have a shed here, you're just going to bring him into the shed
process him. He is ringed already, so he's probably the resident male, but you can see how jet black the wing is.
Yeah.
There's no brown. If that was a juvenile bird, like last year's bird, some of these feathers, the greater coverts they're called, and some of the primary coverts would be brown, you know, and you'd notice the difference. Plus the tail is really square, and on a young bird it'd be more pointed on it.
Right. So, and the eye, very distinctive.
The eye,
yellow,
yes, very,
ring or
very
orange,
orange
ring.
Ring around.
Do you say orange or yellow?
I suppose orange, I'd say, like, yeah.
And the actual, the beak, when you have it up in the hand, you can see so much detail. There's a curve on the top of the beak. It's curving downwards.
That's right, yes, yes. But that's for catching worms or for picking at fruit and stuff. You know, he has a little...
And the very tip of the beak is more yellowy. Oh, there's a poo.
A poo, yeah. Just missed me.
a turd. And the name of the bird, too, is tortoise. Is that right?
Tortoise, that's right, yes.
Anything to do with turd?
I'm not sure, no, what the
I
logic
think
of it is.
The Latin name for
maybe,
But they do have a tendency to poo a lot in the
they
hand.
They do, yes, they do. And if you're catching them in the autumn especially, they'll be feeding on berries, like could be feeding on elderberries or feeding on blackberries. And like the poos then are completely purple and your hands are purple. Like it's like a dye almost. And you know, nearly takes it a day or two to wear off, to wash it off. Like, you know.
Okay, you're going to process this bird. I presume the first thing you're going to look at is that ring.
Yeah, we'll check the ring number, like, you know, so... We can have a check this ring number here. I have to need my glasses at this stage to read numbers.
It's absolutely tiny, the ring.
Yeah,
isn't
it is
it?
Tiny.
It's
yeah.
a metal ring.
It's a metal, yeah, it's kind of an aluminium, like it's soft, very soft metal, like, and very light.
So it's number LC99424.
LC99424.
Yeah. And then we'll be recording, obviously, the species. It's a blackbird, and it's a retrap, so put a little R beside the blackbird. Mm-hmm. And then it's an adult male. So there's a code for the different ages. So this will be a 6M, which means it was born before last year. Definitely.
Can
wasn't.
You tell how far back?
No, you can't tell. You can basically tell if it's a juvenile or if it's an adult, but you can't tell. Like this could be like 3 years old or it could be 10 years old. It'll look the same. You know, so you can only tell adult or juvenile. Now, with some of the birds, you can tell 2 or 3 years. With some of the gulls, it might take them 2 or 3 years to molt fully, like, into their adult plumage. But generally, once a bird is adult, it's just the adult age you get. You can't.
He's very flighty in the hand.
He really
wants to get away.
He doesn't really want to be here, no.
So you're going to measure his wing
now. I'm measuring his wing now. So it's kind of closed wing, and you just stretch it out. So I'm getting 134.
Millimeters,
like, mm-hmm. yeah. So that's a good size, and then I can get a weight on him as well. So I just need
now it's reasonably well. It's mid morning now, 11:30 or so. But it's been very, very cold and very,
it's
very
been
snowy.
Cold, yes, yeah.
So he's probably been fattened up there for the last.
He's been eaten, yeah. Now sometimes, actually, in the winter they can be heavier because in the spring when they start getting territorial, they're spending more time sort of singing and defending their territory than they are actually eating. Now he's coming in at 110.9, and
that's quite grams.
That's quite good, like, but sometimes it could be down to 90, like, you know, and it's more the fact that they're not feeding. In winter they're not territorial, so they spend all their time feeding, or spend more time feeding. But then in summer, then spring, they're being territorial, so they're singing and they're chasing other blackbirds away, and they've less time to to feed. Plus they're feeding, once they have young, then they're feeding their own young. So that's kind of holding up time as well. Right. Obviously he has a ring, so presumably he was ringed here. It's one of my, this will be one of my ring numbers. And it's going back a few years now. I'll have to check in the computer when it was ringed, but it's LC, and it's a while since I've used LC ring, so it could be 4 or 5 years old. Like,
and he's still dropping these feathers
all the
time.
Still dropping these feathers, yeah, just to say it's kind of like that. It's a kind of a stress molt, it's gone.
Having a quick look at him there, he looks in really fine shape. Is there any parasite loading or...?
No, not so much with the blackbirds. They don't seem to be... Now, sometimes you would get little flat flies and you'd see them that come out and crawl along the back of your hand and then disappear back into the feathers. But no, the blackbirds seem to be...
Ticks or mites or anything
No, they don't seem to be to bother them too much, like, you know.
So the greatest problem for him, I suppose, at the moment would be cats, would it, and the cold?
The cold, I suppose, yeah. Like, although, I mean, there is plenty of food here, and, I mean, this is only, like, it's only started snowing this morning. If it lasted for a long spell and, the ground was covered in snow, then they'd be under more pressure. During the last spell of snow now, there was quite a few blackbirds here, and I put out apples, and they were feeding on the apples. And I know it's now probably this one and another female that had a ring. They tended to be chasing the other ones away because obviously the other ones just came in for the food, and the other ones weren't ringed, and you could see the rings on these.
There's another.
He just
two.
got me this time. he's obviously.
So you don't have to do any more processing on this.
No, that's all I need to do. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I don't have to. Obviously, there's a ring on him, so I don't need to put another ring on him. I just record the time and the date and. The weight and the wing length, that's basically it. And the age, like then, which is obviously adult. So that's basically it.
Okay, I suppose it's time to let him go.
Yeah, I suppose you let him off. And
it's just a matter of going to the edge of the...
Just release him back out the door now. And sometimes they squawk when you let them off. And quietly.
And he's nearly gone back to where we caught him from.
No, pretty much, yeah. He's just gone back in under the hedge there now. He's quite happy,
And look at these. Fluttering down along the hedgerow.
That's it, yeah, I know. He'll be.
He's in fine shape, isn't he?
He'll be back for more apples in a while, all right, yeah.
The information that this simple process generates can be remarkable, as Declan explains.
The idea of putting on a ring is that you can identify an individual bird. Like now, that blackbird we've just released, I know now that I've ringed it here. I'll have to check when exactly I ringed it, but I can tell now that when it was ringed, how many years it's been here, and I know it's the same blackbird, because otherwise, like, a lot of people would say, oh yeah, that blackbird's been in my garden for the last 20 years, but how do you know? Like, all male blackbirds look alike, but when you actually ring them, then you can tell that it is a different one, or it is the same one.
Have you caught many blackbirds over the last number of years?
I'm not sure the exact numbers now. I'd have to check that. But I would catch quite a few, all right. And I would tend to catch more in winter time, because they tend to be less territorial in winter. Once you get into the summer, you tend to have a pair in the garden, or tend to be a pair in the area, and you don't tend to catch any other ones until they have bred, and then you start catching young birds, which are probably their offspring. And I tend to catch a lot of young birds maybe in August or September, especially if there's berries, if I've maybe some rowan trees with berries, and they'll come in feeding, and you'll catch them that way. And then, say, in winter time, I would often catch them in the evenings going to roost. They might be going into where there's a little hedge or a bunch of trees. And those ones you would catch a lot of new birds, because they would be, some of them could be birds coming in from the continent even. And I've had some of the blackbirds I've ringed have been found again. Like, one was found in Norway, and all that was found was a ring. Like some guy with a metal detector found a ring, and he just reported it, and it turned out it was a blackbird. It was ringed here in Eden Derry.
So in general, then, do blackbirds tend to move a distance from where they have been ringed?
The local ones would say the resident blackbirds would tend to stay in the area, but then in wintertime we get a lot coming in from Scandinavia, obviously, and sort of northern Europe, where it's a lot colder. But our ones would tend to stick around, and I would often find, like, I would catch a blackbird here that I ringed here maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and so it would tend to stay put. Now in cold weather, extra ones might come into the garden or come in where there's apples or come into the feeders or something. But I think the resident ones would tend to stay put, like. But like that, in winter, you get a lot of extra ones migrating
can,
in.
Can you tell the difference between those that come from abroad?
Not really. Now, what you would tend to get, when you catch them, a lot of the ones that come in from abroad tend to have longer wings and tend to be a bit heavier, and that would be because they're migrants. Most birds that migrate tend to have longer wings than birds that don't migrate. And even within a species, like even within the blackbirds, the ones, say, from Scandinavia that tend to migrate tend to be that bit bigger and longer winged than our resident ones. Now, it wouldn't be a huge difference and there would be an overlap. But I think the one this morning was 133 or 134, like the millimetres, the wing length. But if you got one that was like over 135, you would think, well, that's chances are that's probably a migrant because it is quite long winged.
You were happy then to catch that blackbird this
morning? Yeah, I was happy to catch him, yeah.
Like he's the only one among probably 100 goldfinch.
That's right, yes, yeah. And there was a female there earlier as well, and she was, like the two that I tend to see in the garden are tend to be ringed ones, and it just, even, obviously I can't read the ring unless I catch them again, and it's interesting just to catch it and see, you know, which one is it or how long has it been there. So it's always good to catch a bird with a ring because you'll obviously learn that bit more.
Well, that's the whole idea of it, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. Like ringing them once is fine. It obviously, you can get numbers and you can get, you know, the percentages of adults and females. But if you don't catch them again, you don't really learn that much more about them. But obviously when you catch them a second time, then you can see whether they've moved or what they've done or... Yeah. You know,
or it must be even better if somebody from abroad.
Oh,
it
must be, yeah, of course.
Say,
By the way,
I caught one of your birds.
Oh, yeah, that's all. Yeah, that's true. You're always hoping, of course, to get a distance, like a long distance movement. And I suppose say with the blackbirds, sometimes you'll get them moving to Scandinavia. I think I had one caught in Scotland as well, which was probably a Scandinavian bird
on its way back.
Like, you know. And somebody had, I think it might have been killed, like it might have been a cat or something that somebody had found it anyhow.
Yeah, but at least got the ring.
But it got the ring, yeah, and got the information back, like, you know. So.
Even experienced bird watchers might be surprised to learn that blackbirds are migrants. But one of the key things that ringing has shown us is that blackbirds move around much more than was previously thought. The species is present in Ireland during all months of the year, making it what is termed a resident bird. This masks the fact, however, that large numbers of blackbirds travel to and from this island every year, in search of food and to escape bad weather. Dr. Tom Kelly of University College Cork.
Oh, blackbirds definitely migrate, and they've done a lot of work in this in the UK, and they showed that again, there was a major change after the 1950s, that they discovered that a lot of Finnish birds were being recovered in Britain during the winter months, and they hadn't appeared at all before that. And this indicated that the blackbird was extending its range northwards and eastwards. And this is the enormous value of ringing birds, because it helps to alert people to the fact that a major change is taking place in their distribution, and the explanation for that change in distribution is really important to find out.
But a lot of the ringers will tell you that the blackbirds that they ring stay within that area. So there must be a group of blackbirds that are sedentary or completely sedentary.
Absolutely, because they're territorial during the winter like robins. But then we get falls of robins and we get falls of blackbirds at the bird observatories. And these falls are associated with a major movement of birds into Ireland. Perhaps they've been drifted from in a southeasterly wind from their main track down through Central Europe into Iberia. But the fact is that they do migrate, but Irish birds generally are much less migratory than birds further east. And this is because we have an aseasonal climate and the resources are there throughout the year. Whereas if you go further east, they tend to get very harsh winters, and these harsh winters in turn mean that the birds can't survive there, so they move out, and that's what stimulates migration. The blackbird in particular is very, very susceptible to drought. Hard ground and dry ground are both disastrous for the blackbird. So if the ground is hard, they can't feed on the soil, earthworms and other species that they feed on. And during the summer months when they need to provision their chicks, dry or drought is an absolute disaster. And they could bring off very few chicks in a year in which there's a major drought.
And migration occurs at night. That sounds really weird for birds.
Yeah, migration does occur mostly at night. And the people who discovered that were the people who were looking for enemy aircraft using radar. And they discovered these big echoes, which they called angels. And these angels were in fact huge flocks of migrating birds that cross the country at night and are completely invisible to the naked eye. And we know just from incidental events with aircraft that aircraft do hit birds at night. And we know of places where very wide spaces are monitored by ornithologists and they never see blackbirds flying across them. But then at night, sometimes, albeit rarely, an aircraft hits a bird in that space. And therefore, they are flying across that space at night, but they won't do it during the day.
When they're flying at night, they're obviously, they can't see where they're going.
Oh, well, blackbirds, if they're flying at night, will only fly probably above 1,000 feet and probably up around 2,000 to 3,000 feet. And they navigate by means of the stars. I presume it's the stars. So they'll only fly on nights where the stars are relatively visible. And otherwise, you'll get very little migration during conditions where that's not on.
Bird migration really boils down to one thing, the need to find a reliable food source. Although blackbirds are omnivores and therefore can enjoy a wider diet than many other birds, they are nonetheless rather fussy eaters. Professor Nicola Marples of Trinity College Dublin has studied the feeding behaviour of blackbirds in detail.
I did my original studies during one of my postdocs on blackbirds, in which we found that some individuals, and only some individuals, were really seemed to be fussy about what they were eating. So we were putting out pastry baits, and we were putting out two different colours of pastry baits. And I found that some of the individuals would only eat one of those two colours. And I thought, oh, well, so there's a colour preference. So I actually kind of looked at it a little bit more scientifically, and we trained some individuals on one colour, I think it was brown in that original experiment, brown as their normal colour of pastry. So they'd never seen pastry before. These were new birds that we hadn't fed before. It's uncooked little pastry baits. And it was they were dyed, in this case, brown. So we gave them just brown pastry for a week and then added green pastry so that they had two brown to choose and two green. Little tiny baits. So, and they would come down and they would eat the brown and they would ignore the green. For the birds that I'd trained on brown being their familiar colour, but I'd trained other birds with green as their familiar colour, and those ones just ate the green and ignored the brown. So I thought something odd is going on here. They like something familiar. And I looked in the literature, and sure enough, there was people had said before that animals like the familiar food. But what I noticed, and I noticed it in other birds before this, some individuals were acting like that, and some individuals would come down, they'd eat the brown, and then they'd think, oh, what are these green ones? And they'd try the green ones, and they'd eat those perfectly happily. So we actually found that there's some individuals in the population that we ended up calling dietary conservative. In other words, they're conservative about their diet. They don't want to eat something new. And there's others which we called adventurous consumers, which are happy to try something new. Once they've got over their initial shock, they'll taste it and they'll discover it's yummy and they'll eat it perfectly happily. And what's really interesting about this is that you would expect one or the other of those foraging strategies to work better in a given environment. You'd have thought that always that being DC, being dietary conservative, would be better in some situations. So everybody would become dietary conservative.
Or what about in the opposite?
Or indeed the ACs, the adventurous consumers, you'd have thought that in some environments it would be a good idea to try new foods and that they would get a better diet. And so therefore they would do better. But that's not what we see. What we see is that every single population of blackbirds that we've tested has about a third dietary conservative and about two-thirds adventurous. So that's really strange because it suggests that it's not something that's influenced too much by the ecology that they're found in or the local environment they're found in. So we did that with blackbirds, that was great. And then we thought, oh, I wonder if other birds do this. And we found that that's exactly the same in robins and the same ratio. And it's true of blue tits, it's true of great tits, it's true of zebra finches. We've ended up doing eight different species of birds, looking at eight different species of birds. They all do the same. So we thought, well, I wonder if it's just birds. So we looked at fish, and sure enough, fish do the same. They have some individuals that are adventurous consumers and some individuals that are dietary conservative.
As mentioned earlier, male and female blackbirds look quite different from each other. A biological phenomenon known as sexual dimorphism. that is seen in many birds and other animals, including, of course, human beings. Dr. Tom Kelly.
Well, sexual dimorphism is probably less common in birds than in many other animals. If you look at our own garden birds, like the dunnock, the robin, the wren, the song thrush, the mistle thrush, it would be virtually impossible to identify the female or the male in the field. Of course, if you get them into the hand and look at their measurements, or even better, get to their DNA, you can do it quite easily. Why they're all monomorphic and not dimorphic is not absolutely clear. Now, the blackbird is a notable exception, and it's interesting that sometimes people think that the female is drabber in colour to protect her when she's sitting on the eggs, that she fits more seamlessly into the background vegetation and therefore escapes the attention of predators. But apart from that, I don't think people know why there is this sexual dimorphism in some species and not in others. Now, because we can identify the male-female ratio in the field, we began to do some work in Cork on the grounds of UCC and surrounding urban areas, and we discovered an extraordinary asymmetry between the number of males and females. In other words, there were many more males than females, and this was a statistically significant difference. And again, it's not absolutely clear why, except to say that males maybe have a better chance of survival. That's one theory, that the females, because they attend to the nest and the chicks more so than the males, are more vulnerable to predation and therefore they are killed more often. But it's not yet fully understood why you have this situation where you have many more males, particularly in urban environments, but also in rural environments.
Well, I find that amazing, because I would have thought it would have been the other way round. I thought the females, being the drab colour, much more likely to hide away. I would also think that the females are a shyer kind of a bird.
Yes.
They're not out there, they're not singing, they're not looking for attention.
Yes.
If I look at my own pair of blackbirds in the garden, she's all the time skulking on the ground,
yes,
in and out among the hedges.
Yes.
Whereas he's sitting up there on the aerial,
yes,
or sitting up on the top of the nearest tree.
Yes.
Telling the world, I'm here,
yes,
including all the sparrowhawks and God knows what else that, yes, might be around.
Well, we did some work in that and we tested that hypothesis and we looked at the distribution of males and females with respect to hedgerows and distance from the hedgerow, and we didn't find any difference that was statistically valid. So we think that it starts, the primary sex ratio starts at fertilisation, and then you have the secondary sex ratio when the eggs hatch. And when the eggs hatch, a proportion of them become fledglings, of course, and then a proportion of the fledglings survive. So the tertiary sex ratio is what you see among the adults. And for some reason, it does appear that in the blackbird, at least, there are many more males than females. But, of course, that may be true of other species, but we can't identify it in the field. That's the key issue there.
So, in a nutshell, blackbirds can be either black or brown. Occasionally, however, nature throws out the rule book. Every year, several Mooney Goes Wild listeners report seeing blackbirds that are, for some reason, entirely white. Dr. Tom Kelly.
In the case of leucism, which is pale plumages or grey plumages, again, both of these, as it were, abnormalities are extremely rare. And they're rare because genetically they may be more frequent, but the survival of them is so low that they're very rarely seen. It does happen, though, there's no question. All bird species show evidence of albinism. True albinism, of course, means that the body is completely white, the eyes are pinkish in colour, and the bill may be pinkish, and the legs may be pinkish. So you have different grades of whiteness, if you like. But true albinism is, I think, very, very rare.
County Mayo-based biologist Dr. Karina Dingercus has also been studying these oddly coloured blackbirds.
So we have, we think, two blackbirds that aren't totally black. They have quite a lot of white on them. Used to be only one, but now it's two. And one of them, the white goes, stretches right across its wings. So when it flies off, it looks like a miniature magpie as opposed to a blackbird. And the yard where it's a farmyard where they are, and they're always hang about the same place. And talking to my neighbour about it, there used to be a house there, and an old lady used to live there with her husband. And she used to talk about the blackbirds being, those blackbirds, the white blackbirds as she called them, being souls of the departed. And that's how she saw them. So that lady lived way back in maybe early 1920s. So those blackbirds have obviously been there for that amount of time.
These two blackbirds, are they male and female, or are they both males or both females?
Both males.
And that's easy enough to tell because the blackbird, the male is black.
It's black, of course. Yeah, the male is black. But when they molt, you notice that the coloration changes. So at the moment, the one blackbird that I saw the other day is really, really white. I would say nearly half of him is white. But then in the summer, you might just see a flash of white when he flies away. So we think when they molt, it changes.
Now, you're saying you've seen these for years, so obviously it's not the same birds.
No, it's not the same. It's always basically, it's been passed down. And obviously, the lady who lived there in the 1920s, she was seeing them as well, because she was referring to them as being the souls of the departed. So obviously, they've been there that length of time. So obviously, somewhere in there, there is a gene for this strange coloration, and that obviously repeats itself over the generations.
In the case of leucism, which is pale plumages or grey plumages, both of these, as it were, abnormalities are extremely rare. And they're rare because genetically they may be more frequent, but the survival of them is so low that they're very rarely seen. It does happen, though. There's no question. All bird species show evidence of albinism. True albinism, of course, means that the body is completely white, the eyes are pinkish in colour, and the bill may be pinkish and the legs may be pinkish. So you have different grades of whiteness, if you like. But true albinism is, I think, very, very rare.
One interesting thing I've noticed about blackbirds just locally is that there's quite a lot of leucistic blackbirds, as in ones with bits of white on them, in the grounds of UCD. But we in Trinity here, we hardly see any. And in the rest of the town, we don't see very many. So that's quite interesting because it suggests that there's a local gene that's being spread around that campus. And so, you know, the blackbird has, with some white on him, has offspring. Those offspring have that gene. So they show little bits of white and they settle in UCD's campus because they settle in a nearby territory. And then they'll have children and their children will have the leucistic gene and have little bits of white on them and they'll settle locally. So you'll end up with little blocks of areas with high frequency of that gene.
Could it not be a case, something to do in the diet, might be lacking in the diet on the campus in UCD, not lacking here, and that may cause...
It could, but it's more likely just to be that the gene is locally high density because kids stay with their parents, so or they settle nearby to their parents. They don't fly 20 miles and then settle there if they can avoid it. If they can go to the territory next door, then that's not a bad thing.
There are very few pure albinos.
There are very few pure albinos, but that's natural selection again. That's
your
evolution happening. Yeah. The predators see them so much more easily. That
now,
when a predator
sees a white blackbird, is he not put off and say, oh, I don't like the look of this one?
Well, actually, relating to the dietary conservatism story, yes, absolutely. It's been shown by a fantastic guy called Gottmark, who did a whole load of really interesting studies, actually before I discovered dietary conservatism and called it that. He was saying he wondered whether funny-looking prey was less attractive to goshawks. And he was working on goshawks choosing their prey. So he painted the wings of a whole load of blackbirds and put them out, dead ones, put them out for his goshawks to choose. And they avoided all the funny coloured ones and ate all the normal coloured ones. So yes, indeed, it may be that the white ones get away with survival slightly better than you might expect because the predators are not sure what they are. But on the other hand, they can see them really well. So they'll probably manage to pick them off anyway. And the ACs amongst them will definitely pick them off.
What about breathing then? Breeding as in reproducing. I'm thinking a male blackbird is totally white. What does the female think when she sees a white blackbird?
Very good question. No idea. She must be surprised by that. But they're usually choosing their partners more on song than they are on vision. So it could be that as long as he sings really well, he may get away with it. She may be able to think, okay, he's a bit weird, but never mind. Yeah, but he sings so beautifully.
She's listening to him, to his song, because if he's got a good song, he's got good genes. He's yeah. the guy that I want to father my children.
Absolutely.
But do I want my children to be white?
Well, see, she may be a little bit too simplistic about this and not think that one through, because let's face it, she's a blackbird. So most
she's actually a brown bird.
She's actually a brown bird. But most of the birds effectively use shortcuts to, we call them rules of thumb, because they have to keep their brains quite small. They have to take shortcuts in their thinking. And so they tend to work by what called rules of thumb, little rules that mean that they don't have to process so much information. And with mate choice, quite often, now I don't know if it's the case in blackbirds, but I suspect it is because they sing so well and so lengthily, that the female chooses just on one criterion, and it's likely to be song in blackbirds. So just because he looks a bit weird probably won't put her off too much. But it would be interesting to look at a study and see whether the ones with white on them find it harder to get mates than the ones that are properly black.
She's probably thinking, he's a good-looking guy. He's got a weird hairstyle, but look,
that's right. I'll train him. I'll train him out of it.
Not surprisingly, for such a common and well-loved bird, blackbirds feature conspicuously in many legends and stories. One of the most enduring of these concerns St. Kevin and his encounter with the species at his monastic retreat in Glendalough. Gillian Stewart of the Wicklow Mountains National Park Education Centre tells Terry Flanagan more.
So Terry, if I can just show you here, there's a lovely statue by Imogen Stewart of St. Kevin and the Blackbird. Imogen Stewart, actually, she's a well-known sculptor, but I believe she actually lived locally in Lara for a while. And certainly when I'm here with children, I always tell them that if you rub the blackbird, you can make a wish and it'll come true. The kids love that. Well, feel free to rub it, Terry.
I'll have a go. There's also a line of the first line of the poem is here, isn't it?
There is, here on a bronze plaque here beside you.
And if we look over, we're looking right down at
you
the
are,
cell.
Down
St.
below
Kevin's
us.
Cell.
Yep, down below us you can see all that remains now of St. Kevin's cell, which is a circle of stones. And we're going to walk down and we can explore that.
Isn't the view lovely? Just before we walk down, looking out there.
Absolutely stunning, and especially on a lovely spring morning like today. We have a totally still lake with all the reflections of the woodlands, and we're looking through the lovely oak woodland here in Glendalough.
And I suppose when he was here there would not have been as many oak trees there blurring the vision.
I'm not so sure about that now, Terry. As far as my understanding is that it would have been uninhabited in those days, and it probably was mostly trees, mostly woodland. The woodland now did get chopped down over history, so by Victorian times there wasn't a tree standing. But I believe that when St. Kevin first arrived in about 600 AD, that this would have been an uninhabited wooded valley.
Okay, well then let's yeah. move down. I see it's nicely stepped, so
it
people
is.
Don't fall.
It is, yeah. Nice path all the way.
I suppose the children love it here, do they?
They do. Children and adults both. It's a hugely visited site. So we're coming down the steps. Shall I tell you a little bit about St. Kevin before
yes,
we get
do,
there?
Yes, do. Yeah.
Well, he was, back in the day, he was born about 590 AD. And back in those days, when people were of a religious frame of mind, they would head off, well, men, of course, they'd head off into the wilds and become a hermit for maybe 6 or 7 years at a time. And St. Kevin came over the Wicklow Gap along what is now St. Kevin's Way, the Pilgrim Path, and settled in Glendalough as a holy man. And he was very well respected, and he attracted lots of people to the valley. And it started a 600-year monastic settlement here in the valley. So St. Kevin was the founder of the settlement.
And of course all that's well recorded, especially by Seamus Heaney.
Yes, Seamus Heaney wrote a lovely poem about St. Kevin and the blackbird. St. Kevin is very much associated with the blackbird. The favourite story, I suppose, especially by people who follow religion and St. Kevin and stuff, is that St. Kevin was praying in his cell here, and the cell being very small, he had his arms outstretched. Apparently in those days, back in the early days, that's how people prayed. They stretched their arms out in the sign of the cross. So because the cell was so small, one arm stuck out the window, and while he was praying like that, a blackbird came and laid eggs and nested in his hand. And so he, being a gentle soul, decided that he'd stay there for the full 5 or 6 weeks that it took for the mother blackbird to raise her young.
But there is another story that I've heard. I'm sure you've heard it too.
There is, and this is actually the story I know all the children prefer. I don't believe it's true, but it's more fun. And basically, St. Kevin was living as a hermit here in his cell, high above the lake in Glendalough. And all he was eating was local plants like wild sorrel and stuff like that that grows locally. And there was a local chieftain who had a daughter called Kathleen. Kathleen fancied St. Kevin and wanted him to give up the holy life, settle down and marry her. She decided one day that she was going to come up to him in the cell and persuade him to give up this holy life and, you know, take up with her. Anyway, she arrived at the door of the cell. St. Kevin, meanwhile, had been eating nothing but these wild plants and was probably hallucinating a bit. He looked up and what he saw was the devil standing in the door. So he jumped up and gave her a good shove and said, "Begone, you devil!" And she tumbled down the cliff and into the lake, where she promptly died. Now, when St. Kevin came to after this episode and realised what he'd done, he was horrified and he sort of said, "I'm a holy man, I can't do things like this, I can't go around killing people." So he decided as his penance he was going to stand in the cold waters of the lake with his arms outstretched and pray. And while he was there, a blackbird came and nested on his hand, and he said that was God's way of saying, "You're going to have to stay here for a good while longer." And he did so until the blackbird raised its chicks.
That's not so well known, that verse.
It's not so well known, man. It's probably not an ounce of truth in it, but it's more fun, isn't it?
Okay, well, come on, let's move on down, and we'll move into the cell and see just what is left of it.
Yeah, not much at this stage. You're probably familiar with the beehive huts on places like the Skelligs and stuff like that. Well, this would have been a beehive hut in its day, so probably dating from the time of St. Kevin. Now, we have no archaeological proof that St. Kevin ever lived here, but considering how many, you know, how its name is St. Kevin's Cell, there's a fair chance he did live here. So all you're looking at here now, Terry, is there's a circle of stones made of mica schist, beautiful rock, but all that's left is the base layer. And we believe the door was facing out over the lake that way.
What a view.
Incredible, isn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Talk about real estate, eh? It's a lovely place. And even now, today, even though there's nothing left, only this circle of stones, it's a very atmospheric place, you know, very beautiful spot.
And you can see how Seamus Heaney could produce such a wonderful poem looking out there.
Absolutely, absolutely. Such a place, yeah.
St. Kevin and the Blackbird. And then there was St. Kevin and the Blackbird. The saint is kneeling, arms stretched out inside his cell. But the cell is narrow, so one turned up palm is out the window, stiff as a crossbeam, when a blackbird lands and lays in it and settles down to nest. Kevin feels the warm eggs, the small breast, the tucked neat head and claws, and finding himself linked into the network of eternal life, is moved to pity. Now he must hold his hand like a branch out in the sun and rain for weeks, until the young are hatched and fledged and flown. And since the whole thing's imagined anyhow, imagine being Kevin. Which is he? Self-forgetful, or in agony all the time, from the neck on out down through his hurting forearms? Are his fingers sleeping? Does he still feel his knees? Or has the shut-eyed blank of under-earth crept up through him? Is there distance in his head? Alone and mirrored clear in love's deep river, to labour and not to seek reward, he prays. Prayer his body makes entirely, for he has forgotten self, forgotten bird, and on the river bank, forgotten the river's name.
Be it in legend, song, literature, or indeed the beauty of the dawn chorus, it is clear that there is something about the blackbird that strikes a chord with people, and has done so for centuries. We seem to form a bond with it, an innate connection, if you will, that is shared with few other wild creatures. This human desire to connect with other forms of life is termed biophilia. Psychoanalyst Michael Murphy has studied the biophilia phenomenon in detail and is a strong advocate for the idea of forging deeper emotional and spiritual connections with the natural world.
Okay, Terry, if you take a seat over there, make yourself comfortable.
Okay, thanks very much indeed.
So, what would you like to talk about today?
Well, I'd like to talk to you about wildlife and the effects wildlife have on people. I think it's referred to as the biophilia effect.
The effect, yeah. Love of nature or empathy with the natural world.
And particularly in my own case, the blackbirds, because I have a pair of blackbirds in the back garden and I'm fascinated by them.
Oh my goodness, yeah. That's interesting.
So, really, that's what I'm here for.
Right. So, what would you like to say about blackbirds?
Well, blackbirds, they're probably one of my favourite birds.
I have a pair of blackbirds in the back garden for the last, I don't know, donkey's years now. They're probably not the same pair. But I get such joy looking out at them, putting out apples for them, watching the young when they're there. Listening to him singing every morning is just, it's beautiful.
Ah, oh, isn't that wonderful, yeah. You know, blackbirds, they're a symbol of freedom because they can fly in the air, they can come down to earth and look for grubs and all of that sort of thing. Is that what enthuses you about them?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's the kind of the purity of them, the fantastic colour of the male, the lovely beak, how they work as a team, especially at this time of the year when it's the mating season and when they have young. And it's really just everything about them.
Aren't they very territorial, blackbirds?
Yes, they are. Yeah, so we only ever see the one pair in the garden. But they do a lot for me.
My goodness, isn't that great?
What exactly is the biophilia effect?
Well, it's a love of and empathy with the natural world. And if you go to, for example, a hospice or even a hospital, you'll see that there are lawns round about. There are often gardens where nature is welcomed. And it has a soothing effect on people who are ill, and it helps them heal much quicker. The research shows that the biophilia effect actually helps people to become much calmer, much more in tune with their own being. It's almost like a mindfulness effect, which is incorporated into hospices or hospitals so that people can become much more healthy human beings. Erich Fromm, one of the great German-American psychoanalysts, has written extensively about that biophilia effect, that love of nature. Have you always had that, Terry?
Yes, always. I suppose it was instilled from my father, from a very, very young age, who used to bring us out, show us birds, show us trees. And really, it's something that's lasted all my life.
And the song of the blackbird, what does that mean anything to you?
I've never really analysed the song, but what I would say, it is beautiful. It's pure. You can see him when he's singing, which I really, really like. I can look out at him up there in that tree or on the aerial, and I see him singing. I can hear him singing. And he's as happy as Larry, and he makes me very, very happy.
And isn't that the whole function, from a human's point of view, of the wonderful world of nature and blackbirds?
Absolutely. So really, we should be getting more out of it. Not just me, but everybody.
Do you think that we're beginning to move away from nature?
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely.
And what can we do to rectify that, Terry?
Well, you're the expert, but what would I say? I would say probably slow down in life. Start taking on board what's happening outside the door. Look outside in the garden. Go back to nature. I think it would be well worth it.
So even 5 minutes just being there in the present, listening to the song of the blackbird, looking at the blackbird, that can have a wonderful beneficial effect on people.
Well, I think it's having a very good effect on me. Would that be the same for everyone else?
Hopefully. Going forward, it will be, after listening to what you had to say today, Terry.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Michael.
We leave it there for the moment.
Widespread and common though it may be, in the case of the blackbird, familiarity has certainly not bred contempt. Its enduring popularity is testament both to its adaptability and to its tolerance of human activity, as well, of course, to the sheer beauty of its song.